Hello, everyone, and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Tim Phillips.
And he's back. It's the deep state didn't get you, which is what everyone was super concerned about. It was... There's like, did the deep state get Tim? It's... No.
Yeah.
He's back.
No. I escaped.
More on that.
I have
next
some new
hour.
Ideas, but I escaped.
Okay, let's get to the real show. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans, and we are here every Thursday at 10 a.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new fantasy romance, The Shape of Water. And that's in the back half of the show. For the first half, we'll talk about some of the recent news items from the week, including the announcement that they're rebooting or requilling or something or other. This time, we're talking about RoboCop. And we've got to ask ourselves, seriously, when is enough enough, people? And then, it looked like for a minute there, we were going to get a Crocodile Dundee remake starring Danny McBride as Brian Dundee. but it turns out that it was truly an improbable story because it was actually something about Super Bowl advertising.
Right.
Are we mad or disappointed? We'll talk about that before we wrap at the end of the first half. But first, the Academy Award nominations came out last week, and it seems that we've learned the lessons from Oscar So White a few years ago. And just to give you an example, we're not going to run down, I mean, the nominees. That was like a week ago, and you can find them easily enough on the internet, and to give you an example of like the dramatic shift, that until this year, only four best director nominees have been a woman or an African American. And this year, two of the slots are taken up by people in those categories. One is a woman and one is African American.
Yeah.
And it's almost startling to think that, you know, this is what progress looks like in 2017. It's like,
slowly but surely.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, they're Jordan Peele for Get Out, which I am very, very glad about. And the other one is Greta Gerwig for Lady Bird, which I have not seen. But have you seen that?
I've seen Lady Bird. It was amazing.
Oh, good.
One of my favorite movies of the year. I think it's actually a crime she wasn't nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Director.
There's a number of crimes committed in the name of the Golden Globes.
Yeah, exactly.
Go on.
Yeah. I saw it after the Golden Globe, so I wasn't really sure. And then now seeing it, it's an amazing movie. She did a really great job. Yeah.
So, yeah, it seems odd to me. And I kind of made this note that, you know, I think Natalie Portman made that snide comment at the Golden Globes about, like, here are the five all-male nominees. Right. And a lot of people were like, seem to think that that sent the Academy voters scrambling. I think this kind of proves it right, because it is sort of amazing to me that Spielberg didn't get a nomination for The Post, because it's very, because he's Spielberg, first of all, but this is a very prescient sort of for-the-moment film.
Right.
And, you know, throws the middle finger at the current White House document, which I don't think in ordinary years the Academy would have taken up the opportunity to indulge in hoisting it a bit more onto the Oscar stage. It was nominated for Best Picture, but I think something tells me the Greta Gerwig slot was going to be Spielberg until Natalie Portman got snarky at the Golden Globes.
That could be. I wasn't a fan of Natalie Portman's comment, because then these men who've worked their asses off to create these films are sitting there and they're nominated. What are they supposed to do? They didn't.
It's like
they didn't nominate themselves, right? So
I guess I don't deserve it.
I guess I won't accept it, but. I haven't seen The Post, so I can't really talk objectively about that. But I would say, yeah, Lady Bird is just a terrific movie, and it's so much of it rings true. And of the ones I've seen, I haven't seen all the nominees, but I'd say that and Shape of Water I thought were the two best. And
yeah, I've seen six of the nine Best Picture nominees, which is it's been a while since I've been like on that sort of plateau in terms of being able to talk intelligently about the Oscar nominations.
Yeah, same with me. I've seen six as well. Usually, I watch the Oscars. I've seen two of them. I'm like, I hope one of these two wins. But
it is interesting that I think that Paul Thomas Anderson got a Best Director nod for Phantom Thread. That's the one I haven't seen.
I haven't seen it either.
Yeah, it's still kind of making its way through the art houses. I think that's all, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis, too, his nomination for Best Actor. Mm-hmm. Because it certainly looks, you know, like a ravishingly made film, and I'm sure Daniel Day-Lewis is as good as he ever is, but mm-hmm. I almost feel like that's a bit of a lifetime achievement nomination for both PTA and for Daniel Day-Lewis, because it's supposed to be Daniel Day-Lewis's last movie. It feels kind of like a send-off, a tip of the hat.
Right, and he tends to get nominated for most movies he makes. He doesn't make a lot of movies. It's kind of like the male Meryl Streep without the same number of films under his belt. But
Meryl Streep, who was nominated for Oscar 21, Oscar nomination 21, which is, no disrespect to Meryl Streep or the job she did in The Post. I thought she did a great job. It would be surprising if Meryl Streep did not do a good job. Mm-hmm. But I do feel like that was a slot that could have gone to somebody else. I'm not sure who, but yeah. I feel like that was kind of a, it's like when you watch any kind of award show, there's always like there's certain people show up, like, you know, there's the Emmys keep nominating what's his face, Liev Schreiber for Ray Donovan. Yeah. And it's like, who's watching Ray Donovan? And why are the Emmy voters so fixated?
Does he ever
win,
too? I always see him sitting there, yeah.
He just gets the slot, right? Yeah. And it seemed like it was the same for Kevin Spacey on House of Cards. It's just like, okay, these guys are movie stars doing TV. Clearly, they're better than everybody else doing TV.
Right.
But and I think that's kind of the same with Meryl Streep. Meryl Streep's in a movie. She's clearly acting better than anyone else in a movie. I would have thought that in a year where there was... You're trying to make a point about, you know, equality for women in cinema. The mm-hmm. top three highest grossing movies of the year starred women or had women as the lead characters. Now, I understand maybe Emma Watson as Belle in Beauty and the Beast, maybe not so much. Mm-hmm. But it did sort of surprise me that maybe they couldn't have just given the Meryl Streep slot to Gal Gadot. I mean, obviously she's not going to win, but it would. Mm-hmm. If you're looking to make statements, that's a pretty powerful statement. And it's not unusual for popcorn movies mm-hmm. to get a nomination. Mm-hmm. Johnny Depp, who we'll talk about in a sec with the other side of the nomination stream, was nominated for Best Actor for the first Pirates of the Caribbean movie.
Right, yeah. Having Wonder Woman nominated would have been really interesting, yeah, and that would have gotten a whole audience for the Oscars that they don't usually get, too, right?
Yeah,
like everyone knows about Meryl Streep, how great an actress she is at this point, and it's like, you know, I'm sure there's other actresses too, like Helen Mirren. Every time she does a movie, she's probably like great acting, even if it's a horrible movie. You could probably nominate her for every movie she does too. But it's become this like stereotype Meryl Streep. Okay, she's done a movie. Let's nominate her. It's getting a little bit sickening, actually.
Well, yeah, it's getting a little sickening. So, and in terms of like, what if she does truly exceptional work in a really good film?
Yeah.
Rather than just like sort of these pro forma nominations where it's Meryl Streep, she's in a decent movie. Yeah. Like even Florence Foster Jenkins, that movie tanks if she's not in it. Mm-hmm. I guess that's Academy worthy. But I did notice that on the flip side too, with the Best Actor, Denzel Washington got the Best Actor for Roman J. Israel Esquire. I think that's the exact...
I haven't seen it. Have you seen that?
I haven't seen it either. I it was like there and it was gone. And again, this is like another Ray Donovan where it's like, who was watching this? Academy members.
Yeah, and it's Denzel Washington too, right? Yeah. Like, he did a great movie a few years back, Flight. He had no chance of winning, but then I saw it and I'm like, wow, great performance. Mm-hmm. But there's some of these people, they could probably be nominated for everything because they're just such great actors.
Yeah.
And you're talking about diversity, too. I think an issue with Hollywood has been, like, for African-American actors, it's like, okay, if we want an African-American actor of a certain age, it's going to be Samuel L. Jackson or Denzel Washington. There's only, like, a handful.
Or if you want to go older, it's Morgan Freeman.
Morgan Freeman, yeah.
Yeah.
And like, that's a problem, I find. And I know probably a topic that's coming up, too, with the Me Too movement is that women, like actresses, as they get older, aren't getting the parts.
Right.
And it might be tough for older actresses who aren't Meryl Streep or Helen Mirren to get parts, right?
Right.
There's all kinds of typecasting that goes on in these.
Yeah, it just, you know, I like Denzel too, and I am all in favor of diversity, of course. But, you know, I wonder, could that have been a slot for, like, Andy Serkis, who, mm-hmm. is the pioneer of motion capture, did tremendous work in all those Apes movies, mm-hmm. Or even somebody like Doug Jones, usually buried under so much. It's so interesting watching him on Star Trek Discovery, where he's in makeup, but mm-hmm. he's actually very expressive with less makeup.
Yeah.
And even though he's playing an alien, it's not quite that alien.
Yeah.
But
like Shape of Water, he plays the creature,
yeah.
and you don't hear anything about him.
Yeah.
Like award season, it's, you know, Sally Hawkins and
right.
Richard Jenkins and Octavia Spencer,
who are all great.
Great, and we'll get into it. But yeah, like Doug Jones, you never hear about. I just Googled him, right, and I'm like, oh, he's at Pan's Labyrinth. Just a great performer, but
you know. He's a great, very physical performer. Very different type of acting versus what Daniel Kaluuya was called on to do in Get mm-hmm. Out, or what Meryl Streep was called on to do in The Post. But I think they could have comfortably stretched that a little, especially
right.
since everyone's like, "Well, this is going to be the year for Gary Oldman,
yeah.
who's getting the achievement, basically the lifetime achievement."
Yeah.
Because I think he's only been nominated the one time.
And that with Gary Oldman, I've seen that as well, Darkest Hour, and I did not like that movie.
Oh, interesting.
of the six I've seen that are nominated, by far it was the worst that I've seen,
mm-hmm.
from my opinion. But Gary Oldman did a good job, but I think there's also this tendency for the Academy to nominate best imitation of past politicians, you know? Like he does a good acting performance, but, you know, it's... There's, in my opinion, there's a couple different types of actors who get nominated a lot, and it would be if you're doing a historical figure or you have a serious affliction. It's like those two often get nominated. And that's the cool thing I thought about Lady Bird, Saoirse Ronan.
Mm-hmm.
She's playing a teenager. She's playing a kind of an eccentric teenager, but
right.
just your regular teenager growing up in Sacramento, and she makes that so entertaining, and she goes deep into that character, and that's interesting to see, and I'd like to see more stories like that.
Well, she's an actress too, who's like kind of keeps coming up at the Oscars. Brooklyn, she was nominated for. So she's going to be one of these actresses who they're going to get like 8 or 9 nominations out of, and just like, oh, just give it to her finally. And she's got the Kate Winslet kind of thing going on. Before we move on away from awards, we want to address the Razzies really briefly, because there was an interesting Vanity Fair piece about the Razzies. And if you don't know the Razzies, the Golden Raspberry Awards, which are for the worst movies of the year, quote unquote, it's nothing as fancy or elegant as the Academy. For $40, you can vote.
Exactly.
But
it started in someone's living room back in 1981.
That's right.
Yeah.
I'm sure the Oscars started in someone's living room, too. It just was a very lavish living room.
Yeah.
But Vanity Fair wrote this article, "The Razzies somehow snubbed the worst films of 2017. And they basically said, well, there are no nominations for Book of Henry and The Snowman, which, you know, generally, if you were to consult people who watch a lot of movies, those were probably the two worst in 2017. Meanwhile, mm-hmm. they gave out nominations to the usual suspects like Transformers and 50 Shades of Grey and The Mummy.
Mm-hmm.
Johnny Depp got one for The Last Pirates.
Like, right.
It's funny watching how he started out as the Oscar-nominated role of Jack Sparrow, not as the Razzie-nominated role of Jack Sparrow.
Yeah.
But then Mother gets a ton of nominations for the Razzies, for Jennifer Lawrence,
right.
for Javier Bardem, for Darren Aronofsky, and it's like, I understand not liking The Mother.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it had an F cinema score, so audiences weren't too
right.
taken with
very
it either.
Very divisive.
It's very divisive. I don't think it was one of the worst. I have no interest in watching it ever again. But I wouldn't call it the worst of one of the worst of last year. And I certainly don't think any of the people who contributed to it did terrible work. It's just
they were trying really hard, at least.
Yeah. They swung for the fences and
didn't
quite get there for everyone, and I understand that. But it's like to compare, Darren Aronofsky to Michael Bay is
right
a little lopsided.
Well, the first Razzies, I looked at the nominees for the first Razzies, mm-hmm. and Stanley Kubrick was nominated for The Shining, and Brian De Palma was nominated for Dressed to Kill.
Oh, wow.
And those two directors and those two films made me want to be a filmmaker, basically. So for the 15-year-olds out there who really love Mother, don't take this to heart because obviously, there's probably something there. I've heard like Martin Scorsese talk about Mother, that it stayed with him for 2 weeks after and he really praised the film. And,
it stayed with me, not in a great way, yeah. but it stayed with me. It's disturbing and in all appropriate ways. But you may not like it, but I think there's a difference between the worst and something you don't like. The guys who do the We Hate Movies podcast, they do like a worst of the year series and every January. And so they were talking about like how they choose, and like they could have done things like The Snowman or something like The Book of Henry, which were the worst movies of the year, but they're also want to do something entertaining, like something that's fun to make fun of. Exactly. And I wonder if maybe that was some of the thinking here. It's not fun to make fun of The Snowman, which even the director says he screwed the pooch on. But
and they like to invite guests to the Razzies, like Halle Berry accepted a Razzie before.
She did.
So they would like to get Jennifer Lawrence there, I'm sure. You know, so Tom Cruise.
She might do it.
If they could get Tom Cruise there. So
I think Tom Cruise is too self-important to go, but I think Johnny Depp might.
There have been some famous people. I know Halle Berry's one that comes to mind, but there were a couple
Sandra
other.
Sandra Bullock did Sandra one, too, Bullock. For the one which she did with Ryan Reynolds, The Proposal, where she was from Canada and he wasn't, but that was weird.
Right.
So that's your awards update.
So the Razzies, I think they're just trying to get publicity, right?
Sure.
So that article that we're referring to wouldn't exist if they had just done the Emoji Movie and Snowman.
That's true. Yeah. And that's why you can't really take, I would argue you can't really take a lot of these awards up to and including the Golden Globes.
Right.
Because it's all about publicity. And hey, if you don't like the nominations, pay your $40 and fill out your ballot next year. It's, in the grand scheme of things, it's not that big of an expense.
Right.
Yeah.
Are you going to join the Razzies next year, Adam?
The Razzies board. Maybe. I'll see you at the AGM, I guess. We're going to do a bit of lightning round because we are running down the clock till the bottom of the hour, and we're going to do the review of Shape of Water. But I did want to draw attention to a couple of things. One was the remake of RoboCop, but Ed Niemeyer. He said in an interview last week that he has an idea for like a continuation of RoboCop. So we're gonna forget RoboCop 2 and RoboCop 3, plus the RoboCop reboot, and we're gonna go back and pick up RoboCop where it left off.
Detroit 1990, or
is that where we're going? I assume there would be some passage of time.
Okay.
But yeah, he says he's got an idea and he's working on it, and I'm just like, no. No.
Well, RoboCop's in the future, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the original movie was like 10 or 20 years from 1988.
Yeah.
But it's, I'm kind of getting sick of these. We're going to go back to the beginning. We're going to discount all the ones that came before. And Halloween's doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be interested to see where this goes because I've always been a fan of that series, no matter sort of what they do, or what Rob Zombie and sad Michael Myers trick-or-treating to Rush. And
right. Yeah.
I can live with all that. But I think, because also this week, Ridley Scott was saying that, he has a great idea for Blade Runner 3. and my immediate thought there was like, Ridley Scott, you are not the reason Blade Runner 2049 was enjoyed as much by critics as it was, and you're not the reason why it did not have a successful run in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were incredibly lucky that 2049 turned out as well as it did.
I really liked it.
I liked it too. I liked it a lot. But it, you know, just leave it alone. You got you got really, really lucky.
Yeah.
And I feel the same about RoboCop, because when the RoboCop remake was under production, I thought, you know, it could be good. Mm-hmm. Because when you're talking about Detroit, and it came out in 2014, I think. When you're talking about Detroit in 2014, vastly different world from what Detroit was in 1988. Mm-hmm. So it could have done something really interesting, and it was trying to do some interesting things, because we understand robotics and computers better. I mean, as like sort of lay people out here in the audience, we mm-hmm. understand those things a bit better from our own lives. So it could have played with a lot of really interesting things, and it ended up, you know, kind of not. And you know, it was very obviously Vancouver. you know, it seemed to go out of its way to sort of avoid playing with those things, just create a standard robot shoot 'em up, and mm-hmm. it could have been great.
So is Paul Verhoeven involved at all?
It didn't say anything about Verhoeven. Although I think he recently did an interview where he's like, he thought maybe he was too jokey for in movies like RoboCop and Total Recall, and I think that's what people like a lot about them.
That's why they become cult movies, really.
That their social satires, tongue in cheek, with some of the stuff, like, you know, I'll buy that for a dollar, and those running gags. That's what people like about them, and certainly when you think about Paul Verhoeven, I think that was an aesthetic he brought. That wasn't anything that a producer's note came up with. We need more jokey, I'll buy that for a dollar gags.
Yeah, it's hard to replicate that. You get somebody like Verhoeven, or you get like John Carpenter with Halloween. They have their own eccentric personalities that they bring to the table. And then when you try to replicate it down to the second, third, fourth, fifth iteration, you know, and try to turn it into a formula, then you're going to fail eventually.
Yeah.
It's just going to get repetitive, right?
Yeah, it's a victim of overthinking it, too, because these are cult movies, which means they're movies that kind of clicked incidentally with a small audience, regardless of the fact of how commercially successful they were. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you go back to reading how John Carpenter came up with Halloween, and it was just like, you know, Askin came, you know, had like $300,000 lying around, and he wanted somebody to make a movie about babysitters getting killed, and John Carpenter was given that budget and those caveats, and voila, you have Halloween.
Yeah.
And now you know David Gordon Green, who's directing that, and Danny McBride, who co-wrote, it's like, you know, it's like they're kind of lobotomizing that. You know, how do you kind of reverse engineer Halloween into making it relevant for today? Mm-hmm. And it just, I don't know if there's a formula, and I think we keep trying to figure out the formula.
Yeah.
And
it's just like add iPhones and
So it's not something replicatable. It's, you know, the time and the personalities and the restrictions, and it's a soup that, you know, mm-hmm. you throw in all these parts and you bring it to a boil, and it's intuitive. It's not something you can put in a calculator, I guess.
Yeah. The restrictions lead to greater creativity.
Yeah, exactly. Speaking of lack of creativity, what did you think of Fake Crocodile Dundee? Fake Crocodile Dundee Gate. It was
it's kind of stupid funny, I would say, which is what they were going for. So I think
it speaks to the times that we kind of bought it so easily. Like, of course they're going to remake Crocodile Dundee mm-hmm. with Danny McBride as Mick Dundee's son. It just something about that just makes sense.
Yeah. Just pure comedy. Yeah. Because the first Crocodile Dundee movies weren't pure comedy, right? They were mm-hmm. kind of comedic, but there's action and adventure and all that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, the comedy came from the fish out of water stuff, mm-hmm. when she's in Outback, and then when he goes back to the city, and, you know, this is a knife and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It is funny. It is funny that it did turn out that some people were suspecting, like, is this like a jinx or something? Or is this a hoax? And it did turn out to be that this is this viral campaign that the Tourism Australia is running, mm-hmm. I guess, using, you know, their most well-known ambassador, Crocodile Dundee.
Yeah. yeah, it's there was something came out a couple of years ago, I think, for like Ferris Bueller, There was like this brief ad, and it looked like he was playing hooky from work. So everybody thought, and I was like, that would be awesome, a Ferris Bueller movie where he's like in the dead-end office job and he's taking the day off.
Ferris Bueller's Office Space. Yeah.
But then that just disappeared. I think it ended up being something to do with a car commercial or something.
Right. Yeah. Right. I mean, it's hilarious that the atmosphere in Hollywood now is like the dearth of creativity is so real, so tangible that you can't even really joke about it because people will instantly assume the joke is real.
Yeah.
And so there will be no Brian Dundee, son of the legend.
Working on it now that the popularity. Like, oh, shoot, we need to write a script for this now.
People want to see Brian Dundee? That's crazy. Anyway, we'll have to leave Brian Dundee for another day. We're going to play a bit of music now. A bit of Creature Comfort from the Arcade Fire in their latest album, and then we'll be talking about Creature Comfort of another sort in Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU, 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
She dreams about dying all the time. She told me she came so close. Filled up the bathtub and put on our first record.
God, make me famous, but you can't.
Just make it painless. Just make it painless.
There's pee freckles on the ceiling now. How'd they get it up there? Just how big a target do they need, you figure? Ain't get enough practice, that's for sure. My Brewster, no one's ever called him a great mind, but even he manages to hit the can 7% of the time. Excuse us, sir.
No. That's all right. Go ahead. You ladies seem to be chatting enjoyably. Girl talk, no doubt. Don't mind me.
And that uncomfortable moment in a men's room is brought to you by Guillermo del Toro in his new film, The Shape of Water. It stars Sally Hawkins, Doug Jones, Michael Shannon, Richard Jenkins, Michael Stuhlbarg, and Octavia Spencer. And as we mentioned at the top of the program, it is the winner of 13 Academy Award nominations, which is very, very impressive, not just because it's Guillermo del Toro, who's a Mexican filmmaker. It is also impressive because the Academy has quite often gone out of its way to not acknowledge fantastical movies, mm-hmm. even when they are very, very good. Like, this is very, very good.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
It's worth noting.
Yeah, it's a great movie. Actually, I was thinking for the Academy Award race this year how the two movies I've liked the most that I've seen are The Shape of Water and Lady Bird. And it kind of reminds me of a few years back when Birdman was up against Boyhood, which I like both those movies, but
that's
totally different because Boyhood was like Lady Bird, straight ahead family drama, and then Birdman was fantastical, and they gave the best Oscar to best picture Oscar to Birdman that year, and Shape of Water's looking pretty good to win it this year, and
Very true.
Yeah, could be a fantastical year at the Oscars this year.
I think. To begin with, let's, I think it's basically like Beauty and the Beast through the filter of the Creature from the Black Lagoon. It's almost like what happens after the end of Creature from the Black Lagoon, and they bring it back to America. And of course, Guillermo del Toro, very influenced and inspired by those films, the original Universal monster movies. So it feels it plays into his wheelhouse very, very well. I think he also developed the story and co-wrote the screenplay, so it has his sort of fingerprints all over. What's interesting is, aside from Doug Jones, it doesn't feature a lot of his, and this was true of Crimson Peak as well, but it doesn't feature a lot of his sort of regulars, like people like Ron Perlman and
Ron Perlman Thomas would have Kretschmann. Fit in as a thug for the CIA or
you would have. I mean, maybe a bit too well. I think that was kind of his part in one of those. It felt like that was his part in one of those Blade movies. He was a thug, the one in Del Toro made. Mm-hmm. But so it's very much Del Toro. It's very much something different from him as well. It's an interesting film because it's, as we mentioned, it's fantastical, but it's very, very grounded, and it doesn't do the usual things that these movies do. Like the soundtrack, I'm kind of interested to go back and listen to the soundtrack by Alexandre Desplat. Mm-hmm. It's not like a typical like eerie creature movie soundtrack with a lot of strings and a lot of high-pitched sounds. It's almost like a very romantic movie kind of score, where there's like nice strings and there's it's very kind of mellow like that, considering that a lot of the film takes place in darkness. This lab that the creature is kept in, and there's no windows. Sally Hawkins's character Eliza and Octavia Spencer, who co-worker is, they both work at night. Mm-hmm. So much of this is sort of phrased that way. Very few sort of day scenes.
Yeah, but like you're saying, like the score does reflect sort of a lightness about it. There's an old school Hollywood vibe.
Yeah,
and Del Toro does do some shout outs with a classic movie theater there, and some classic films on the screen. And I guess it takes place in the early 1960s. Mm-hmm. So there's a big theme of like repression and trying to break free from that and being judged for being different.
Yeah.
And, which is interesting because the characters are a mute woman who's roommates with the closeted gay man, and then there's and best friends with a black cleaning lady at the facility that they work at. So you see people at the margins back in the early 1960s. It's really interesting to see this in this fantastic movie, such deep themes and a lot of really good actually comic relief coming from that. People laughing despite their lot in life, being able to get through with a laugh. So
it's fascinating because it is. You also have Michael Stuhlbarg, who's a Soviet spy working in the facility,
right?
And they all sort of come together to save the creature, who's himself sort of like the ultimate outsider because he's not human. Mm-hmm. So you have all these outsiders sort of coming together to save the man who is, or the creature who is the ultimate outsider. And I think that really speaks to our times. There's so much in here that sort of is echoes of what's going on right now, even though it does take place in the 60s. So you have like the Russia connection, and we know what's going on there. You have some Me Too stuff in here because the Strickland, who's the villain played by Michael Shannon, there's a moment where he very clearly is like sexually harassing Eliza, and very uncomfortable sex scene with him and his wife where it's all missionary, and the racial stuff, as you said, there's the struggles of Giles, who's the Richard Jenkins character, who's a closeted gay man, who is always going to this pie outlet.
And the pie outlet is in Toronto.
Yeah. Well, it was all filmed in around Toronto.
And the cool thing, the pie outlet's a Lakeview Diner.
That's right.
Which is really cool, which is very strange because I've been there like a dozen times. So to see that on the screen, I was like, oh, is that the Lakeview?
Yeah.
And yeah, the visual effects were really cool. They were done by a local Toronto company to like sort of erase Toronto from the from the screen, yeah. Unfortunately. But yeah, and to give it that old early 60s vibe as well.
The streetcar tracks are always a dead giveaway, though.
Yeah.
I remember, it's so funny, I remember some Mark Wahlberg movie based on a video game, its name I can't remember, but there's a scene where it's like, it takes place in New York, but there's a scene where it's like walking across the street, and it's very clearly Queen Street because you can see the streetcar tracks in the middle of it. You can sort of play with that when you're talking about a 1960s setting because there were still lightly some trolleys in some places, or the trolley tracks were about to be torn up. But
yeah,
that's, you know, so you can play with that a bit. Yeah, the setting is so particular. Mm-hmm. And the scene in the pie, you do get the impression that Giles has gone there quite a lot to work up the courage to. Yeah. To talk to the proprietor, who he thinks is also gay,
right? Yeah.
And there is that like really, it's really heartbreaking moment where he finally summons the courage and he reaches out and puts his hand on the guy's hand and says, "I would like to get to know you better."
Mm-hmm.
And that's it's such a subtle touch because it makes you appreciate just how hard it's been for this character to live. Live a lie, first of all, but also to how he tries and forms, you know, what we would consider normal human romantic attachments, you know, because this guy's immediate reaction was like, no, I want you out. This is a family establishment.
Right.
Because, you know, if you live a gay lifestyle, you can't possibly have family values.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just such, like, great little moments like that.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a great moment because then after that, he goes back to Eliza, who he had a huge argument with prior to that. And then he realizes and he's vulnerable and says, "You're my only friend here." And it just shows the sort of the outsider nature of everyone. And truly outsider is the love between the creature and Eliza as well. That relationship takes place. It's a sexual relationship.
Yeah.
And
it doesn't. The movie doesn't shy away from that, and it doesn't shy away from sexuality much. And you know, we see Eliza a couple of times in, let's call them, intimate moments.
Mm-hmm.
And then when she does rescue the creature, it does handle very tastefully that this is also, yes, a romantic relationship,
right.
A sexual relationship.
Yeah,
and they do a very good job of laying out why there's an attraction there, because of course it's like, ew, he's a gross slimy monster, but
right.
To her, no.
Mm-hmm.
She's as alien to him as he is to her, and there's never a moment where when she first like encounters him where she's like freaked out or scared. There's none of that. She's always like from the get-go approaches the creature with curiosity and understanding, and it's very, very pure in that way. And even when it's interesting, the effect, because there's Eliza has a conversation later on with Octavia Spencer's character about after her and the fish man enjoyed the pleasures of the flesh, let's say, where Octavia Spencer's like, well, how do you even, she visual with her hands how it worked, and Octavia Spencer's reaction isn't to like go, oh, that's disgusting. It's like, oh wow, well, you guess can't trust a man, can you? It's so delightful that there's the kind of treating this unusual entity, the idea that it is a monster and that it is that's sort of a devil creature to be feared, it's all from the point of view of like the main white character, the main white male character, which is Michael Shannon, who, you know, has a gross component of his own. The creature bites off two fingers.
Yeah.
And he gets them reattached, and throughout the movie, his fingers are slowly dying, and they become more black and more. You see he's like pus grossly ooze from his fingers.
Yeah.
And that's another really great touch too.
Yeah, and Michael Shannon's the total antagonist throughout the opening of the film. But then you start to feel for him at the end when his superior.
Right.
It's kind of like in Star Wars, it's like Darth Vader, but the Emperor is pulling all the strings, right? You see how they were all part of this machine, and he's just trying to like provide for his family. He has a lot of problems with like racism, sexism, all those problems, but. You find out at the end, you start to feel for him just a little bit because he's under pressure from his superior. Like, you need to do this in 48 hours or you're dead, pretty much. You know?
Yeah, just like you're not going to get your promotion. You're not going to be demoted. It's just like you're over, you're done. This career you've like invested so much time into. And the general has an interesting line where he's like, you know what? The decent thing, I can't remember the exact line, but he's like, the decent thing would have been to like not screw up in the first place, which is like, you know, there was something that just resonated with me about that, you know, because Michael Shannon's like trying to make the case that, you know, how could I have predicted like the creature would have got away? Like I've had this like perfect career working with this general. It's implied they go back to like the Korean War together. So like 10, 15 years. I've had this like perfect career service. I made one mistake, or like one time this thing got out of hand, and the general's like, "That's one mistake too much." A decent man doesn't apologize for his mistake. A decent man doesn't make mistakes in the first place,
right? Yeah,
which is incredibly damning and incredibly counter to, you know, how the world works. We all make mistakes.
Yeah,
it's. You know, that something like that is just so deflating. Like, you invest in a relationship with someone, you sacrifice for you know, a lot of us sacrifice for our bosses and you know, try to prove that we're worthy employees, and sometimes going above and beyond the job description. So we can identify that part in Strickland too, but then the general comes back, it's like, no, one mistake is too many. And of course, it goes back to the beginning of the film. Because one mistake did cost him everything, it turned out. When he gets to, I guess he was like maybe torturing the creature a bit too harshly, lost himself, and the creature bites off the fingers. We don't really see how or why the fingers were bit off. Yeah. But from that, they invite Eliza and her friend to come and clean the lab, which introduces Eliza to the creature, which starts the whole ball running.
Then she's...
And so one mistake does... end up undoing him, which is just the fascinatingly circular detail in the script.
Yeah, exactly. And he's definitely set up as someone, he's definitely the evil presence in it. But then you start to see these other elements too, like the Russian puppeteers who are like saying, okay, we want the corpse of this creature.
Yeah.
If we can't have them, the Americans can't have them. You know, it was that whole Cold War paranoia and we're competing against the U.S. for everything. And if they have something, we want it, kind of thing.
And the character's walking such a great line. And there's a moment when he's talking to his superiors, the Stuhlbarg character, who's Bob. His American name is Bob, but his real name is Dimitri. But he's talking to his superiors, and he's like, they order him to kill the creature before the Americans can kill it and dissect it. And they give him, you know, instructions and a way to do it. And he says, you know, I didn't come here to do this. I came here to learn. And his superior says to him, you didn't come here to learn. You came here so they wouldn't learn. So there's like this purposeful... In the midst of the Cold War, there's this purposeful, you know, match between the Soviets and the Americans, where the point isn't to... Because part of this is they want to learn from the fish man, like, you know, his biology, which they think can help in the space race and all that kind of thing. The space race, of course, is always framed as this grand era of exploration and daring. Of course, it was all based on the idea of getting something completed before the other side can.
Exactly.
And that was very framed in that moment. You're not here to learn. You're here to make sure they don't learn, which is like, which adds this layer of a war of who has the greater ignorance in terms of the Cold War, which shades, of course, the entire movie, because it is very much about ignorance versus acceptance.
For sure. And Eliza's the one person who sees the creature and doesn't think, oh, this is a monster, that sees him almost like as a person. Mm-hmm. So this isn't a monster that I can manipulate, or it's, you know, this is some being I want to be with, you know?
Yeah.
And I really like how it's handled. It's handled so well throughout, the fact that when they first begin their relationship, that there's that humor you talked about, Octavia Spencer asking, well, how did you do that? Because as an audience, and Del Toro totally expects this, as an audience, first reaction is going to be to laugh a little bit about this, right? Not to take it seriously.
Yeah.
But it's funny, after that initial humor, how serious the romance gets throughout the rest, and how you as a viewer are there for every twist and turn for that romance for the entirety of the movie, you know?
Well, Del Toro does an interesting thing where he frames it as a fairy tale. And he did the same thing in Pan's Labyrinth, too. It was it's kind of bookend with these, like, narrations that this is a kind of a fairy tale. It may not be 100% real. But then it's so grounded in the fantastical elements are so grounded in a way. It does draw you in. Mm-hmm. And it does feel very real. And, the great thing about that relationship is that it's not that everybody kind of wants something from the fish man. Even Giles, who he's healed at one point of a cut, and it has an ancillary effect of, like, having him regrow some hair on his head.
Yeah.
And so he's kind of fascinated by this, you know, let's keep him around because, like, maybe I can get a bit younger. Because he has a line in the beginning of the film that if he knew what he did now when he was 18, he would he would certainly change. And that's a very universal dynamic too. But the relationship between Eliza and the fish man, they don't want anything from each other than companionship. Mm-hmm. And you know, in this sort of era, that's, you know, that's tough when you're a pertinent person of a certain class and of a certain certain stature. It's hard.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of very simple basis is what kind of sells you on it. It doesn't matter, like, he could be, you know, Portuguese or or something. It doesn't really matter. And it's fascinating too. And Octavia Spencer hit on this, and I read it, like, an interview with her where she said, you know, it's fascinating that you have this story between two characters, this love story between two main characters who never speak to each other.
Yeah.
And that leaves puts much of the speaking in terms of the phrasing of the feelings and what's going on, that puts that on the black woman and the gay man.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have this, it's still a hetero romance, even though it's because it is a fish man.
Right.
But it is up to, also in the end too, not to spoil anything, but it is up in the end to the one gay man and the black woman to sort of share the story, I guess.
Yeah, they almost help out, like, they're almost like older siblings helping out, or these people who are in trouble and need help. But I thought Sally Hawkins was amazing without saying a word in that
She's
movie.
She's so good. She had such a great year, because we did Maudy too.
Yeah, I thought she was terrific in that as well.
And I was a bit torn. It's like, what's the better Sally Hawkins movie this year? It's better Sally Hawkins performance, this or Maudy. It's tough to say.
Yeah.
They both came with very different and unique challenges.
She's such a great actress that she can do that. Like, Maudy was all about her speech and her body and how she was in poor physical stead, but still, you know, fully cognizant and intelligent and creative.
Yeah.
And then in this, it's, she can't talk, but she's still a loving, very intelligent human being who's needs what we all need. And it was great, and she can elicit, like, emotional responses. She's just such a great actress. And
yeah.
I think I'd really like to see her be the Meryl Streep of the next 20 years.
Let's have Sally Hawkins usurp Meryl Streep's position in Hollywood. it's so, it is interesting, because she's not a quote-unquote conventional leading lady, too. And it's interesting to hear Guillermo del Toro, because he's in an interview with him, he said that she was the kind of the first choice, the first and only choice. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, to go with like another actress, and I think what he meant to say was kind of like a younger actress. But, you know, it would be to sort of make this look and feel like a perfume commercial. Mm-hmm. And I'm butchering his words, but this is kind of what he was getting at. And I agree with that. He went on to say that, you know, this is a story about the woman who might sit next to you on the bus, mm-hmm. and who you might not take notice of, but within her is an incredible beauty and radiance and a joie de vivre, let's say. Mm-hmm. And I think that's Sally Hawkins' real gift, is that in not just in this role, but in a lot of her movies, is that she's not the woman you'd cast in the perfume commercial, mm-hmm. but there's something incredibly artful and beautiful and inspiring about not what she does in The Shape of Water, but also a lot of her roles too. Mm-hmm. You know, she's wasted in something like Godzilla, where she's, you know, following Ken Watanabe around talking about motus and stuff. But in these kinds of things where she's allowed to take center stage and allowed to shine, she is so amazing. And she's asked to do so much in this. Like, she's asked to do like underwater stuff. She's asked to do a lot of physical stuff. There's a out and out old fashioned Hollywood song and dance sequence in black and white too in this, where she has to sing and dance. And
that's the one moment she doesn't speak throughout, but then all of a sudden she starts singing and dancing. And,
of course, because in her like fantasy world, of course she would be able to speak and be able to say the things to the creature that she couldn't say. Yeah. Although they don't have much of a problem communicating. Mm-hmm. That was another, I thought for sure, I mean, that may make or break the movie for some people. It's just like
that song and dance out of nowhere.
Yeah. But I think Del Toro owned, I think he earns that, those little touches.
I liked it, and it lends itself with that old school romantic vibe that you're talking about too, right?
Yep.
With the old movie theaters, the scores, old and upbeat, and so it lends itself to that, the fact that she's in love, she's truly in love, and shows her expression in her mind of that, right
so it's and you know, Doug Jones too, I think deserves a lot of credit, because this is a very physical performance, mm-hmm. and it's all in makeup, it's all like a rubber suit, it's a very well made rubber suit. I think there were probably some CGI touches with the eyes and the some of the light. He's bioluminescent at points, but we've come to sort of expect these creature effects, whether it's done by CG or makeup, but they can be quite cold unless you have an actor who's like really dedicated to the physicality of the performance. And it is really tremendously disappointing to me that he did not get an Oscar nod.
It was a great performance, and I like that Del Toro had him in a suit as opposed to total CGI.
Yeah, like performance capture. It adds to that when you put your hand on him and it comes off slimy. Another credit I'll give to Del Toro is in Lesser Hands, he would have there would have been this like tease about seeing the creature and slowly revealing him, and Del Toro's like, none of that. It's like, I have this big, awesome, beautiful creature. Let's have a look. Because there's one scene at the beginning where they bring the creature in and he's in this like tank that you don't really see him. But then as soon as we kind of get into the open lab, we see the creature for all his glory, and it's almost I was going to say voyeuristic, but it's not voyeuristic, but it's just, you know, Del Toro's very confident. It's like, look upon the monster, love the monster. He's a great monster. Mm-hmm. And it really doesn't mind indulging you in those details, because of course the instinct is to be shy about it and then have a big reveal rather than just turning a corner and there he is. Like any other sort of romantic lead, you turn around and all of a sudden there he is.
Right, yeah, and that's a great thing. You really hit it there, Adam, about this movie. It just has all those everyday details. So it's making the fantastic like something that plausibly could happen, which is great as a viewer because then you're really invested in it. It's not. And when you said before about the perfume model, and that's often what you'll see in an actual comic book. It'll be like, okay, the thing from the sea is with a blonde perfume model or something. And the fact that these are just everyday characters and it's not not something for your average fanboy, I think, is why this is really doing well across demographics. And the fact that something so fantastic with a creature, with the love affair with a woman, is touching so many people.
Yeah. Agreed. So go check it out. The Shape of Water. Very well worth seeing. And that is an end to our show for this week. Unfortunately, we have to call it here. You can go to our website, endcreditsradioshow.com, or you can find us on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show, or on Twitter, End Credits Radio. Tim, where can people find you on the internet? You're not hiding from the deep state?
I'm working on a play for Fringe now, so we're going to be sending out some casting calls and crew calls, but if you're interested, it's called Joy of Sax. It's a comedy. flashinthedeadpan@gmail.com, or just Google Flash in the Deadpan to find my particulars. Thank you.
Excellent. And I will be back here later today for Open Source's Guelph. Scotty Hertz will be away, but I will still be here. I am always here. I am the fishman of CFRU, I guess. Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we'll be back here next Thursday at 10 a.m. for more end credits. And we'll see you then.